your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are grass make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. With me is Tony Gosling from Bristol, England. Welcome, Tony Gosling. And you've been on here before, and you're more than welcome each and every time. Welcome, Tony.
You know, I think I'm becoming your Britain or Europe correspondent here.
My connection to the soft underbelly of the UK.
Well, I mean, I think it's fair to say that Bristol, I mean, we've just won in Bristol the Best City in Britain award for the best place to live. I mean, this is apparently, if you score what people say about that, what they like or don't like about the city they're living in, Bristol comes number one, which is, that was whilst I was away, actually, that came out, the BBC reported that poll. And it doesn't totally surprise me because, you know, although London is where everyone thinks, you know, oh, London's the place to be, it's getting too crazy in London. Yeah, it's getting way overcrowded. I mean, I don't know if you know what happens if you squeeze too many monkeys into the same cage.
Right. Bad things happen, right?
They do. They start scratching each other's eyes out. You know, they've done experiments on this sort of thing. And London's getting a bit like that. I mean, everyone's running around like blue-ass flies. They're crazy. You know, it's a little bit too much. And the rents make it very stressful to earn enough money in order to pay the rent, at least for most people. So London is just a little bit too much. It's also like this. It's a very, you know, in some ways positive as a kind of melting pot of cultures. And the British, over the years, for their sins, have kind of encouraged crooks and despots from all over the world, of course, to come to London saying, well, this is the place to be, guys, so they can get them all together and hatch plots around the world. That's, I think, the establishment's way of doing things. And MI6, for example, that's one of the things they like to do. They, you know, for example, in the 1980s, they would get all these kind of, you know, more extremist Islamic groups, invite them to come to London, you know, say, well, this is, we here, we've got the Finsbury Park Mosque, we've got these radical groups there, you'll be at home, you know. And they were actually, they called it Londonistan, and they were actually trying to get as many that as they could to come to London in order to hatch plots or, you know, Islamist plots around the world. So that's what London's like. Bristol, though, much more laid back. It's almost, when I first arrived in the city, it was like a village, in a way, a village feeling in the city centre. You know, you go to shops, they're very chatty people, always got time of day to pass with you. And, you know, the other thing is it's very creative. There's a lot of creative industries. You know, we've got these various filmmakers, animators, great, couple of great art centres, and it's, I think historically, you know, it was one of the centres for the campaigning against the slave trade because, you know, you've got sailors coming in and out of the port constantly over the hundreds of years who have seen a few things, you know. These guys have been all around the world. They've seen, you know, Singapore, Australia, you know, and they're well-travelled and knowledgeable people who know what really goes on. And I think that's one of the benefits a city like Bristol has.
Well, that's good, Tony. What do you have on your mind this evening? You said something earlier about the judge and Aleppo, you know, convoy and stuff.
Let's start.
Bring us up to date on some of these things.
Yeah, let's start with the big news around the world. Look, what frustrates me so much in this propagandistic Orwellian age is the way you've got a massive story, whether it be the Syrian chemical weapons attack in the Idlib province, or this recent attack just a couple of days ago on this this refugee convoy in Aleppo coming out of the al-Qaeda al-Nusra controlled areas near Aleppo, and you're just not, the basic questions are not asked. You're told this is what's happened, and there is no interrogation of the facts. So you will be told a fact that contradicts what you're being told happened, and yet that is supposed to sit happily in your mind. Of course, this is often known, I mean, in a technical way, people talk about this as cognitive dissonance. But what I'll say with this one particular attack, and it is particularly horrendous, when people who've been desperate to get away from a conflict zone, who have been being used as human shields for months, if not years, finally an agreement is made to get them out, and then a bunch of civilians are then blown to bits by a bomb. Now, we're told immediately this is a suicide bombing, some guy's driving a truck and he's blown it to pieces. Well, look, this bomb was enormous, George. I don't know if you've seen the pictures. Of course, you can look them up. I think it took place on the 15th of, maybe possibly even Easter Saturday, the 15th of April 2017, near Aleppo, and there's about sort of 10 or 20 coaches which are just completely blackened by the blast of this bomb, plus of course loads of other people nearby, and we hear the death toll is risen up to over 100 dead, including 68 children dead in this convoy. So okay, we're being told it's a suicide bombing, but let's ask a few questions. First of all, with the vehicle that this bomb was in, if it was in a vehicle, and the driver dead, how on earth can you tell where, and blown to bits, obviously spread across a rather large area, how can you identify that as a suicide bombing? How do you know that the vehicle actually had a driver in it? I mean, in the normal scheme of things, the vehicle could have been parked. It may not have even been a vehicle. And it could have possibly have been a bomb in a vehicle that the driver didn't know was in the vehicle. This sort of thing happens quite a lot. I spoke to a guy from Bristol who was half Iraqi, half British, citizenship, both countries. And he was explaining to me that when they were in Iraq, they would be taken out of vehicles, but with the US Army doing searches on the vehicles. They got back into the vehicles, and as the vehicle started off, the guy said, "There's something under the seat here." They lifted it up, and the Army had actually planted a large bomb underneath his seat whilst the vehicle was being searched. So this is, I think, entirely possible and entirely feasible, that quite a lot of these so-called suicide bombings are not suicide bombings at all. Look, I mean, you and I, George, know a little bit about how the military works. If you're going to blow yourself up, the only real sensible place to be doing that is against a hardened target. That is to say, somewhere that where you cannot just leave a bomb and walk away and someone else or yourself press a little button and make it go off. Why on earth do you need to, lose your life? That's the only time that you need to, there's any kind of reason to do some kind of suicide bombing. This was not that kind of situation at all. Against a non-hardened target, there's absolutely no point. I just wondered, maybe I could ask you to comment on whether you think, George, about the necessity of a suicide bombing against a civilian target, a marketplace or something like that.
Well, it's terrorism is what it is. It's not a major military target, so it's just to create chaos and terrorism in the population at large.
You don't need to have a suicide bomber at all.
No, you don't, because there's all kinds of other ways to do it. That's right.
There's 100 different ways to do it.
Right.
So I had quite a good look this time to see, and there's absolutely no evidence that this was a suicide bombing at all. We're being told about suicide bombing. It's almost like a kind of mantra
that is part of
war on terror. So not only that, I mean, when I was studying the very early outbreaks, I think it was 2005, of the Shia uprising in Iraq after the invasion, that was caused by the shutdown of the Al Sadr newspaper in Baghdad, because there was a big follow, a big newspaper, and you know, it was a weekly newspaper, and one of the front covers of that, they said this apparent suicide bombing wasn't a suicide bombing, it was a drone attack, because all the eyewitnesses at a bus stop opposite this building that had been bombed said there was a missile came down and hit it, you know, and it wasn't a suicide bombing at all. So this is another thing, is with these Hellfire missiles coming down very fast from the sky, suddenly there's an explosion. Nobody would necessarily notice or know that it had come from a missile, come from above, or it had come from below. So what I'm doing is I'm really questioning, as journalists should be doing, the whole entire narrative of this idea of, is this a suicide bombing? Because what happens, as we know, is that people like Agence France-Presse, Reuters, Associated Press, the Press Association, the usual suspects, just churn this stuff out as if it's gospel, whereas actually it's all coming from the same sources. They're usually police, press office sources, or military sources, and they're not checking anything. They're not asking any questions. So, number one, this is a horrific attack. But number two, there is no interrogation whatsoever by our multi-billion dollar mainstream press about what's actually happened. So, you know, the result of this, it seems to me, is really, I mean, first of all, of course, it's a war crime if it's got anything to do with the West, which it may have, because they seem to be the closest to the Al-Qaeda. You know, certainly not the Syrians. I wouldn't say it's not likely to be them at all, because they're part of the arrangement to get the people out. It's also, I think, a fraudulent narrative that we're being sold here. And also, these people, of course, the idea is to punish them. And also send a very strong message to anybody who is a human shield, because that's effectively what these people were in these Al-Qaeda ISIS-held territories, to say, well, look, even if you start thinking about trying to go escape from the Al-Qaeda areas, from the Al-Nusra ISIS areas, and, you know, make your way out of here, we're just going to blow you to bits if you try and do that even. So it's sending a very, very, very frightening, very evil message.
Yes, it is. They've done this before around in Aleppo, reported. There have been other reports, not to this scale, but about individuals being stopped leaving.
That's right. And quite often they will simply execute people if they, you know,
they were shooting people, snipers. I know there were some reports of snipers shooting people trying to come out.
Well, why do you think they do this?
Well, it part of it is to try to control the population there and using them as shields and stuff, you know. I think some of it's pretty straightforward. Here they're reporting that it was a vehicle, you know, a vehicle with a suicide bomber driving. I don't know, you know. Like, you're bringing up some really good issues here, and I think that's what we as reporters and journalists have to do. You know, we have to question everything. I think that's healthy, you know.
My question is, why aren't they? I mean, you know, we're inching towards a third world war, and it looks like all our journalists have just gone out to play tennis or something, and they're just, you
you're
know,
right.
They're,
you're, well, this observatory thing has been suspect. It's the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. They've been releasing all kinds of derogatory or contradictory reports, along with the white helmets, see?
Yeah, and I think, you know, you've got quite a lot of setting up of various organizations outside Syria, controlled by the West, that are supposed to represent Syria. This is one of the main problems. And something that you don't get the journalists looking at properly is this site news agency and this other AMAC news agency.
Propaganda all the way, Tony.
I suggest people have a look at both of these. Site, which is search for international terrorist entities, if you can believe that. And the thing that worries me is that all of our major news agencies, including people like CNN, MSNBC, all the rest of them, the BBC, etc., all pay them a whacking subscription, something around about, something like $8,000 or something to subscribe to their website. And yet all their feed being fed is basic reports, which you can get on the web anyway, plus propaganda. So, and they'll say, for example, they'll say, ISIS has claimed this attack. Now, who is site? You have to start asking, who are these people who are claiming attacks for ISIS? Especially interesting that ISIS seem to be, on other parts of the internet, people who are claiming to be ISIS saying, we want nothing to do with these people. They're not spokespeople for us. And yet the Western press just picks this stuff up, multiplies it by a million viewers and sends it out to the world as if it's the truth. Plus then you've got another news agency called AMAC News Agency. I think you need to look at also them. For example, they were the agency that told the world's press that ISIS had claimed the attack on Westminster Bridge. That's AAMAQ, AMAC News Agency. Now, ISIS sources have again said the same about AMAC, is they say that, well, AMAC are reporting some of the things that ISIS do, but there are also things that we totally, you know, that they have absolutely no connection with us. So they're just scooping things off the internet and then also claiming to represent us. And they shouldn't, and they don't. So this is where I think where we're at now is the actual source of so much of the information, whether it be this bomb attack against this civilian convoy. And, you know, your heart has got to go out to people like that. They're in the state, they're over Easter, that they just think, thank God we're going to get out of here. And for someone to have it in their heart to kill all those people. It's a little bit like a Nazi collective punishment, in fact.
That's what it sounds like, yeah.
It's and it
those poor civilians over there have suffered so much. I mean, God. And Syria is just a
disaster.
Yeah.
That sort of mentality where you have absolutely no compunction about killing hundreds of civilians.
Yeah, right. Did you ever cover this Robert Perry report on this drone that he eludes the gas attack, you know,
I would just say Robert is generally a very, very good source.
Yeah, what do you think about that? What's your view on that? What's your comment?
Well, I mean, you know, this is exactly what I was saying about the attack on the convoy in Aleppo. I think there's a lot of use of drones and Hellfire missiles going on that people have absolutely no idea that it's happening.
Right.
And so they'll be reported as a suicide bombing. It'll be reported as, you know, some kind of bomb attack or whatever, a plane dropping a bomb or whatever. But actually, these drones are ubiquitous and they're flown by all sorts of agencies.
Yes, those drones are dangerous. You're right.
Well, they're difficult to trace, George. I think that's why they're used.
Well, yeah, in his article there, he alluded to the Geospatial Intelligence Agency as them having a hard time in tracing back to that secret base in Jordan, that drone. He said that in a general way. But it was vague in his source, of course, because it's an inside source, he's saying.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's very difficult to quote, you know, it's just that if he's heard this stuff and if he can give a bit more evidence, that would be helpful. But I think it's certainly.
But it's a hard thing to dig into.
Yeah, it's a question of, I think you've got to keep an open mind on a lot of stuff, and you've got to, the most important thing in any kind of journalism is you've got to be very careful about whether you're expressing fact or speculation. And what's happening is the mainstream press is just expressing speculation as fact.
Yes, that's right. On the Russian connection on Trump. What do you think about Trump's, this North Korean thing is dangerous to fool with, isn't it? Huh?
Well, of course it is, but I think at the moment it's just rhetoric, I'm hoping, you know.
I hope. They had a missile failure there. Do you think it was an ICBM or not? They don't know for sure, I don't think.
Well, most of the analysts seem to say they haven't got that sort of capability, that they could roughly reach as far as Australia, but certainly not reach the US.
I know the change, Tony, that's occurred. They've switched over to solid fuel. Maybe they're having trouble with this new solid fuel rockets.
Also there's a suggestion that there was some hacking going on. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, the North Koreans have made a decision. They've said, well, we're seeing a lot of independent non-nuclear states around the world just get invaded and attacked.
Yeah.
And we've had this tension ever since the end of the Korean War, where there was never any actual peace treaty signed, of course, at the end of the war. And we've decided we're going to go for nuclear weapons. So we're not signatories of the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Right.
So they're not obliged under international law to do it. I mean, you know, one does wonder whether international law stands for very much nowadays, since, you know, particularly the US and the West is tearing it up day after day.
Right.
But, you know, that's their decision. And I think, you know, you can see why they've made it, because there's a guarantee that comes with having those sort of weapons. And it may be just simply be as cynical as this, George. Well, look, the US thinks that the North Koreans, or the North Koreans think that the US thinks that the North Korean weapons cannot reach continental United States.
Right.
And so the US won't see us as a threat, but we do need these weapons to defend ourselves. And, I mean, it's a horrible thing to say, but that's one of the byproducts of having this kind of gung-ho policy of the West around the world, you know, in places like Ukraine, Syria, Libya, Iraq, just sort of invading countries willy-nilly. I mean, of course, Iraq being an illegal invasion, this sort of thing, you know. So if you start doing that, then other countries that are independent are going to start to get worried.
Right. Yeah, Stephen Kinzer, in his book, The Truth Flag, has set out all this imperial attack throughout the world in the last 100-plus years. And I don't know, America's been very guilty of too many foreign ventures, that's for sure. Yeah.
Well, the British have been alongside.
Yeah, they're partners in this, the geopolitical system. And the British are masters at this, you know. They are masters of mind control and brainwashing. They got that COGS unit over there, and they've got deep research ongoing all the time, you know, at their key universities. And so I've been working on that, looking at it since the 80s, mid-80s, you know. So it's really a mind foundation, you know, mind research foundation, you know.
Well, there's also in Central London the Tavistock Institute.
Oh, yeah.
Which is,
yeah.
Sometimes called MI4.
You're right. Yeah. I sat down with Lynn Swan in 2006 at the Tavistock downtown there. And also went out to the clinic and talked to people out there on the outskirts of London. They have a clinic outside of London, then their main office is right on the edge of the financial district there. And I met with Lynn Swan and talked to him. But it's like a sister organization to the Aspen Institute here in this country, you know.
Yes, we've got a lot of that, haven't we? The sort of mirroring across the
they did. They conditioned. Yeah,
you've got these kind of Harvard scholarships, and then you've got the Rhodes scholarships in Oxford.
Right.
So they bring Americans over to Britain. And however dim they are when they start, they try and turn them into presidents.
Right.
You know.
Well, Kurt Lewin, this group management and group, you know, psychology and stuff, he's the father of it out of Germany by way of the Tavistock, and he finally ended up here, but dying early in life. And he was the father of that whole system that Tavistock began to capitalize on, and Aspen later on. And they made a scientific dictatorship out of the whole deal, it looked like.
Yeah, so then there's also this week, the death of Sheila Abdua Salam. That's Abdus, Abdus,
okay.
Salaam. Now, she was America's first female Muslim judge in the entire U.S., and she was found dead last week in New York's Hudson River. Very strange. Looks like she's been suicided, George. I mean, apparently the family is saying that she didn't really have any kind of reason to kill herself, and that she was quite amazed and proud of her achievements as, you know, taking that role as the first judge. So, I mean, you know, there's been almost no reporting of this, which is extraordinary.
Yeah, go on, Tony. That's interesting.
I'm just shocked that something so momentous, really, you know, somebody being found dead, we can just again accept the police saying that it looks like suicide. That's basically the end of the story.
Oh, okay.
It's about four or five lines of news. I mean, and yet this is quite obviously quite significant. You know, it was particularly in this far right climate of Islamophobia, where you know there's an attempt to demonise Islam. This kind of thing should be looked at properly, and not just we should not just accept New York Police Department's word for it, or the FBI, whoever has been sort of overseeing this. That's it. You know, the first ever female judge in the whole of the United States. It winds up in the Hudson River, fully clothed. What is going on? I mean, I don't know from over here in the UK, but one thing I do know, my copper's instinct tells me that something's up. You know,
right.
What's happened there?
Exactly. There's so many people have died under mysterious circumstances over the years that were in top and high position, too.
But I mean, you know, the thing is, I think you've got to look at what's going on with the whole Islamophobia thing. I mean, it seems obvious to me now, over the years, been studying all this, is that you've got a kind of modern version of the anti-Semitic thing against the Jews that Hitler was running and his friends over in Germany. You know, there is a whole group of society that apparently are the worst thing since sliced bread, and you can't do anything, you can't trust them, they're dangerous, blah, 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 and she's just another victim.
Right. The Saudi family, though, was run by the British for years, see, because of the oil. So that when you look at that oil early on in the early 1900s, when they started really drawing those lines across the Middle East, the royal family and the Saudi family are just tight, along with the Bush and all those other people. So it's hard to break that up, see. It's a very hard group to work against. Kissinger's in there.
No, the other news is we've just had, of course, is that President Erdogan has won his constitutional referendum as well.
Yeah.
He's going to be in possibly until 2028. I mean, this is.
Oh, now that just passed today, didn't it? Huh?
Yeah, it did. Yeah.
But you notice these fixed elections, and there's controversy about running in ballots that were not stamped already. Okay.
Yeah.
So when you see that, are they cheating on the referendum? But that thing, they put out some misnomers on this. The president's position under the existing or the old system, I guess what you're going to have to say, was very powerful because they had appointment power that was very great, and Erdogan was working out of his new palace, which is a grandeur palace, and his best friend runs the equivalent NSA in Turkey. See, so he's building a real dictatorship over there.
And with he is.
In this, they'll cement it and conclude it totally. You know what I mean?
Well, I think this is a result, really, of last July's coup attempt.
Yes.
I mean, I think that what they've seen is that, look, Turkey is a great prize for somebody if they can, you know, get some of their people infiltrating the military, infiltrating the government, and grab hold of power. So I'm afraid, I mean, I'm going to have to, in a way, side with Erdogan on this one.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you've got a tremendous amount of influence of social media and stuff like that on what the people are thinking and what the people are allowed to see and what they're not. And you've got all the, because Turkey is, look, okay, let's just take a step back from all of this. I think over the last decades, you've had, since World War II, what's built up is this enormous great kind of tension, a positive and negative style tension between the US and China. Ever since the 9/11 attacks and the military escapades in the Middle East since then, that's had the effect of shifting Russia, who had been virtually, I mean, you know, after 2000, when Russia was beginning to be part of the West, part of the G8, etc. What it's done is it's shifted what was the sort of balancing power, Russia, over towards the side of the Chinese. And so Turkey is right in the middle of all of this. And it's also part of NATO. So they've decided, obviously, over there, look, There's a war coming. We can't afford to allow our country to be taken over. We need to take very firm control of the reins of power. Now, you know, you can see why they're doing it. You know, this is the crazy stuff. I mean, maybe there's quite a lot of people in Turkey, maybe not more than half, but nearly half, that have also decided that they need a strong leader. I mean, this is where we're going, isn't it? We're in the 1930s, getting towards the end of the 1930s now, in a way now.
Right. When Iran was put under the sanction system, Erdogan was using gold to help the Iranians. And there was all kinds of, and that's where they probably hatched the plot to go in and take him down, see. The West did, see. So, and then he and his sons were profiting from the oil sales by ISIS into Turkey, too, during this occupation period here in Syria. So, he's not totally clean. His skirts are not totally clean, see.
And, no, definitely. Look, I'm not saying that. I mean, let me just make it clear. They're all gangsters.
They are. Like I said, what they're doing, he's got a large following of Islamic following in Turkey. I wrote a piece on this a number of years ago, and I had to drill down into it. And they're probably the worst example of Gladio. You know what I mean? But multiple levels of it. You know what I mean?
Absolutely horrendous.
Yeah.
Yeah, George, I'm going to have to go in a minute. But final thing I'll say is I think we're seeing just some news about things like the London bankers are deciding, Lloyds is deciding for the first time that it needs a major headquarters outside of London, and they're putting all their chips into Berlin as their main European headquarters.
Okay.
But you see, this is what was happening again. This is what was happening in the run-up to World War II. Is when there's a war coming, these bankers aren't stupid. They make sure they've got a skyscraper in every camp, you know? So there were so many companies, for example, Shell were doing it. There's loads of examples of different companies that were doing it. They had operations, Ford, for example, in Nazi Germany and in and in the West.
Right.
And that worries me, you know, that you've got this going on. This is another indication.
With the decline of Deutsche Bank, that Lloyds connection into Berlin could be the thing they're working on now. See?
It certainly could.
Yeah. Okay, Tony, thank you for being with us this evening. You've come up with some really good insights and things that we can point our audience towards, and that's real great.
All right, George, thanks again.
Okay, good night. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Bye-bye. Thank you again, Tony. Tony's Gosling has insights to some of this that are not, you won't hear in the American news community or even in alternative news. But he is alternative, and he brings up subjects and points that are very, very interesting and very, very insightful. So I want to thank you again for being with us this evening, Tony. What we're seeing, just want to bring up a little bit more information here about President Trump. And U.S. Representative Gabbard was saying that his attack on the Syrian airbase was rash, or actually I think she said reckless, you know. But so perhaps that is the case. So I believe, if anything, what would serve President Trump better is to take a little bit more measured response to some of these world conflicts and events. And I think in making a response in a more measured manner with more intelligence and information than the decision, I think would be much more enhanced. But I think he's an impulsive person for that reason. Now, let's get back to there's indications with the signing of the web bill recently, and then these attacks and things like that, and the North Korean problem right now. But there were things on the campaign trail that President Trump, you know, he actually was speaking, Banyan was speaking through candidate Trump on the campaign trail. And now they seem to be turning, I guess, the establishment or the neocons or whoever is exerting the most influence on President Trump seems to be dissing and successfully Bannon's role in any future White House policy making. And I think that would be a major mistake for President Trump to make. And the reason is that President Trump, he aroused people because of the swamp and the corruption in Washington, D.C. and so forth. And I think that he had good intentions about what he could do there. And I think Bannon is really right there. That's his home territory, see, about trying to reform some of this corruption. But I believe that neither Trump nor Bannon fully appreciated or realized the depth of that water in that swamp and the deep state power and the civil service and all these other people that form part of the D.C. establishment that for decades have exerted a tremendous amount of power in the Washington, D.C. area and the federal government area and the expansion of it, okay? And I believe a good point was made by Jonathan Emard the other night on a talk show. And he is an attorney up there, someone I've come to respect. And Jonathan Emard, E-M-O-R-D, you'll find him in the web and so forth. But anyway, he seemed to make a statement about administrative law, I think, that was a very cogent and a very insightful point. And I think it's something that needs to be repeated. And basically, he said that administrative law acting through these agencies, actually, they don't separate the different powers of the different branches of government, but they use all three branches and all three rights and powers of the three branches, but together. Like these agencies are actually writing regulations and so forth and rules and regulations on their agencies. They convene courts that make decisions on licensing and many things like that. And then they also act with punishment through fees or actually penalties and fines. And so Jonathan Emard was saying the other night that this goes against the Constitution totally because it's taking a governmental agency and giving them the rights and privileges and powers of the three different branches in three different ways. It depends on the particular agency or administration and so forth. But basically what happens there is that it gives these agencies a very powerful tool to act against the ordinary citizen. And that's what's happened. And I believe that the people that were supporting President Trump on the campaign trail were people that were sick and tired of big, big federal government, big, big agencies, big, big administrations, not listening to them and forcing the big government's will on the average American citizen. So I believe that if there is a movement to the center, I think it's a fatal error on the part of President Trump. Whoever's advising him to do that, I think, is dead wrong. And I think he should have held his stance as far as working for the individual, the average American. And I think that Webb bill, he should have never signed that. And I believe that these entanglements that Jefferson spoke of, these overseas entanglements, the Syrian thing, we were promised to come out of there and let Syria settle it, but also to go after ISIS. And so by attacking the Syrian air base, it indicated that he's going to get more involved, against Syria. And but I think the average person wanted to move away from that entanglement in Syria. Now, the North Korean situation is different. About a year or so ago on the air on this station, on this program, The Secret Truth, and we broadcast every Saturday night, 7 to 9. We bring in Tony Godling sometimes, and another good guest is Patrick Wood. We've had on Stephen Kinzer. He's written a slew of just fine books. and we've done about 600 programs over the well over 10 years that Charlotte Littlefield and I have been on the air. But the North Korean situation, about a year ago or so, I spotted a movement. I had a gut feel that China would join in with us to do away or to tone down or to hush up or to take away the nuclear capability of North Korea. And I believe that when the president of China met with Trump, I think they struck a deal that, yeah, let's join in together and let's do something about North Korea, because the problem with North Korea is it's becoming a regional danger, not only to China itself, but to South Korea and to its neighbors, Japan, Taiwan, and other neighbors close by in that area. So I believe that the belligerency that has been expressed by these threats and of attack and with nuclear capability, there have been some assertions made that some people don't think he has the nuclear capability that he has expressed and declared that he has. The weapon systems recently on this big show, this big parade, the 100th anniversary there of North Korea, demonstrated, I think, to many people that he has weapon systems and he has mobile weapon systems that are on the ICBM classification and type. Now, this recent test of this missile that went haywire and was a failure could have something to do. Some people are saying that we sabotaged it, but he has recently, in the last few years, converted over from liquid fuel rockets to solid state. So in this solid state missile technology is not that reliable at times if you do not get the burn progressing in a correct way. If the solid fuel begins to burn improperly, or it's lopsided within the hole at depth that they begin the burn, then you can have real problems. So there might have been a solid state problem in his missile accident just recently. So that put egg on his face. So, you know, he has perhaps the missiles that he could fire off and get them, but does he have the miniaturization of the nuclear weapons and things like that go along with that missile technology? But I believe that we're proceeding towards resolving this problem, and I'm just fearful that there might be outright war with North Korea. One of the most dangerous things that I've been talking about in Japan is Fukushima. I believe that our authorities right now, and I think should take note, the Japanese and Americans, of making sure that there is additional protection around that plant. We've had three meltdown reactors well over 6 years now. And so we need to make sure that an attack against Fukushima could not be mounted by a very belligerent North Korean government. So anyway, that's so much for North Korea. Now, let's get back to Trump, President Trump. In coming, seemingly, it seems like, to the middle, he's going to lose a portion of his very conservative, supporters and his base. And it will that result then in a fatal error being committed where he cannot get those people back? And it could be that these insiders are persuading him and moving him to the center, which could be a fatal error. What I would have done, if, you know, in my advice to President Trump, is that I would have tried to win over, and he was beginning to do it with some policies. And I believe that he could have won over the middle to left, the center to moderate left, over to his political persuasion. And I think that would have done more good overall for a second term, you know, if it comes down to that. Otherwise, the deep state and the establishment still don't want him there. They're pushing. They're trying to normalize him. Some people I hear talk about trying to normalize President Trump by making him do more of what the neocons or the liberals want in different on different issues. See, but and so that appears to be an ongoing process, and I see that's happening incrementally. See, and so. He's a pragmatist more than an idealist, and so that's what we've got to try to understand about President Trump, is that he deals with very pragmatic situations, and he might diss someone a few weeks before, like Yellen way back, but then he'll say good things about her in the short term, because there's something that he wants to utilize her ability or her power in getting accomplished. See, so I would say that President Trump is more of a pragmatist than he is an idealist as far as standing on principles. So that's where you've got to start being more knowledgeable and aware that this is his thinking. See, so that with that said, the Bannon thing, if Bannon's hold on, just sit there. And continue to espouse what you really believe in, because I believe that the speeches that Trump gave, they did hit a nerve out there in middle America. They are upset about many of the things that I believe that were in those speeches. And so my advice to Bannon, Steve Bannon, is just hold on and don't quit. Stay in there. There are people that support your ideas. There's more people out here than you might think. Now, in the meantime, I'm hearing from many of the Trump supporters or a community of a part of the community of supporters that they're through with Trump because of some of the things he's done recently. I think what we have to do with President Trump is we're not through the 100 days yet. So, and I believe he's still in a learning curve. He's still not out there in foreign affairs. I think there's people that can put the britches on him. I think they did recently, and they drew him in to quick decisions, which I don't think he should have made. He should have taken more time and been more cautious, and because these interests are. In some of these quick decisions, it's going to undermine his credibility, which I think it's already lost. He's already lost some of the support of his supporters that got him into the White House. So I think he got to be careful in here and start thinking about these things. And I would say this. I would think that his own judgment probably is better than some of the generals around him and so forth. He's made decisions, but it's primarily been on business. And one thing about business decisions versus what he's doing today is that business decisions didn't cost lives normally. It cost money if you made a wrong decision. The decisions that he's making out of the Oval Office now in the office of the presidency, you're dealing with people's lives and you're dealing with the families of those people and so forth. Those men that lost their lives on that Syrian air base, they had families, they had children, they had jobs, and they were protecting their country. They were dedicated to that. So you've got to think about the long term and be more cautious in making those decisions. We are entering a civil war of psychology, of a war of a culture war. It appears that Hillary's supporters have coalesced into a very, very leftist, collectivist left that is mean-spirited, and it's not good. It's Alinsky types of techniques and so forth, but also the Bernie Sanders group is in there with them, but they're not the mean-spirited part. The Bernie Sanders people were the more moderate, gentle, socialist, liberals. But there is a segment in there that is really hell-bent on getting Trump out at any cost. Now, if Trump did make the wrong decision, I think he did, in coming to the center, then he's lost a good portion of his conservative right, and they're not going to come to his defense then. So is he setting himself up in his latest decisions to be moved against decidedly by the by some of the former conservatives that supported him, you know, that wouldn't move to the center, and they're not going to defend him, and by the leftists that are still out to get him? Because I believe the deep state, they still don't want him, see. He's beginning to be normalized by those people, by the neocons and so forth, and he's beginning to do some of their bidding on these wars and this this military force, which they are proponents of. They love, the neocons love to go out there and strike out at these foreign countries and use that military force and power. This is not the way to win friends and to establish real democracy, democratic republics throughout the world. But the problem with this thing is that the real big movers, shakers, the New World Order, the people that are running things behind the scenes, they do not want a democratic republic. They want to extinguish this one. And they don't want those ideas promulgated and nurtured and grown in any other nation state throughout the world. They're looking to shut this country down. They're looking to control it more and more, and with more and more regulations, more and more surveillance techniques, and not provide additional freedoms and liberties, but to subtract away from the average American liberties and freedoms, of which they're quickly now becoming extinguished little by little. So we've got to hang in there as Americans. We can't get mad at people. The minute that you react in a, to someone that's very, very cruel, what is going on? Let me just state this. We've got about 6 minutes left in this program this evening. But whenever a very cruel person starts getting to your goat, so to speak, and riling you up, that's the minute that they're exercising control over you. And when you come back in the same manner, they've got you, see. They'll manipulate you through upsetfulness of you. They'll upset you, make you mad, make you hateful, and the reaction to all that is not good. The way out of our predicament is not to allow people and not to go for these kinds of overtures of manipulation. And that's basically what it comes down to, is that people that upset you, that make you mad and so forth, they know what they're doing sometimes, and sometimes they don't, but they're like that anyway, see. But there are people that know that to control others, they can start upsetting them. And when they upset other people, then they're creating a monster that they can manipulate through that upsetfulness, see. So we've got to respond to people that are very cruel people, but in a measured, in a very rational, well thought through, but not with hate and resentment. You know, when you do that sometimes, and our friends do this, and our family does that to us also. So it's not just so-called enemies or adversaries that do this to you. But within a family unit, you're going to find people that don't treat each other right or use each other through making people mad, and then the reaction is what they won't see. Through a control system. So you've got to try to see how that mechanism is and how detrimental it can be to our freedoms and liberties. And that's really what we're talking about, is that what we're talking about something here that is so, so simple. And what I've preached for years now, and I've written books on the subject, is that we must begin to forgive ourselves and others. And through that way, the people that are upsetting you, you begin to understand what they're doing and why they're doing it. Some people are not fully conscious of it because they've been conditioned into a very mad-filled state anyway. They're upset, and they just push it off on other people. Well, I want to thank everybody for listening, and once again, we broadcast live from Austin, Texas, every Saturday night between 7 and 9. what we've been doing is trying to get original shows going for the first hour, and then we'll rebroadcast another hour. This last Saturday night, I put in there a program called Confessions of a DC Madam. And basically what I was trying to do was awaken people to this pedophile epidemic that's been going on for decades in this country and worldwide, and especially in Europe. And we've got to try to overcome some of this. The top elites out there are involved in many very dreadful, very dark activities. And what we have to do is we have to aware of these activities and, you know, try to cut that out. I mean, stop it. We've got to become aware, and we've got to go after people that are like that, because it's destroying this country. And we've got to try to come back to our American principles. And in that, I mean, I run into these millennials all the time, and they say, well, you know, old white man, you know, wrote the Constitution and everything. But I don't think they fully realize or appreciate what some of those guys were doing and what they brought to bear. One of the founding ideas of many of the founding fathers was natural law and natural rights. And they brought that and imputed it into the document, the Declaration, and in the Constitution, and setting up this three branches and checks and balances and things like this, and trying to incorporate. But what any man creates, another can undo or circumvent or whatever, or destroy in the long term. And that's what has happened in this country. We've had a rise of administrative law that has destroyed the court systems, and the federal government is just tuned into that and maxed it out. And it's not good. And versus constitutional law, everybody's talking about administrative law, see. And that they're two different things. But we had a rise of administrations and agencies before and especially during World War II, that was just phenomenally large. And what we got from that big rise was a tremendous government, size of government. And FDR was right there building it, and many of the people were adamantly against many of his policies. But otherwise, he did bring us through World War II, and we had to fight this Nazi machine over there. And they were going for world power, see, along with the Japanese. And so we just had to do what we had to do with what we had, and we mobilized the country quickly, and it did work. But anyway, thank you, Tony Gosling over there from Bristol, England. Thank you for your views. Don't agree with every view, and you don't agree with my every view I have, but we certainly mutually respect one another. So tune in to thesecrettruth.com. Our programs are on demand after we broadcast. You can find us also on Facebook. But thank you so very much for listening and being very supportive. And we as Americans have to come together and quit fighting and quit being so divisive with one another. We've got to wake up to what is really going on. We've got to protect our liberties and freedoms and begin to love one another once again. Thank you and good night.